This is Sparks from Radio Fax. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Ese amor llega así, esta manera, no tiene la culpa. Caballo le dan sabana, porque muy despreciado, por eso no te perdono llorar. Ese amor llega así, esta manera, no tiene la culpa. Amor de compraventa, amor del de pasado. Ven, Belén, 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 ven, Belén. Bambolea, bambolea, porque mi vida yo la prefiero vivir así. Bambolea, bambolea, porque mi vida yo la prefiero vivir así. No te da perdón de Dios. Tú eres mi vida, la fortuna del destino. El destino te desaparado, lo mismo ya callé, lo mismo soy yo. No te encuentro lavando, eres posible, no te encuentro de verdad. Por eso un día no cuento si de nada, lo mismo ya callé, lo pienso en ti. Bambolea, bambolea, porque mi vida yo la prefiero vivir así. Bambolea, bambolea, porque mi vida yo la prefiero vivir así.
Porque mi vida yo la aprendí a vivir así. Bambolea,
Bambaleo, the Gypsy Kings. Thanks partly to the EEC's efforts to improve road safety and the advance of electronics into our cars, strange concepts such as congestion monitoring, cruise control and auto-tolling will become quite commonplace for road users in a few years' time. One of the key companies involved in turning these concepts into working, usable systems is GEC Plessey's Semiconductor Microwave Division in Lincoln. From Components in Electronics, Chris Evans-Pugh reports. Although one tends to associate the microwave industry with military communications, the RF, microwave and millimeter wave bands are being considered for a surprisingly diverse range of applications. The more cynical amongst us would put this down to diversification in the microwave industry's shortage of traditional military business. While there's an element of that involved, the fact is that the lower frequency bands are so cluttered nowadays that there is little choice but to head up the spectrum. Also, microwave systems offer considerable advantages in terms of bandwidth and data carrying capacity when compared to the infrared and ultrasonic systems that have so far been used in automotive applications. Microwaves are also far less sensitive to environmental conditions. GEC Plessey is working on a number of microwave and millimeter wave systems for the automotive market, some as part of the EEC Drive, Dedicated Road Infrastructure for Vehicle Safety in Europe, programme, and others, such as in an in-car intruder alarm, on a purely commercial basis. GPS's most successful development in this area in terms of volume business is a transponder it has designed for the Vapor Corporation's Road Check Automatic Vehicle Identification System in the US. AVI is a concept that has been around for over 10 years and is basically a method of keeping tabs on vehicles. Although it's used in the US for monitoring road usage, collecting tolls, fleet management and so on, it has been slower to catch on in the UK, although it's beginning to gain acceptance. Vapor's road check system is, I suppose, what you'd call the state-of-the-art in AVI, and is currently being installed in Arizona as part of the HELP, that's Heavy Vehicle Electronics License Plate, program. RoadCheck is a semi-active microwave setup consisting of a vehicle-mounted transponder, antennas and a roadside electronics cabinet. The antennas are built into the road surface, allowing vehicles to be identified in free-flow situations without the need for gantries or toll booths. These antennas can detect transponder-equipped vehicles passing at speeds of over 100 miles an hour. GEC Plessey's transponder is a small unit, around 20 centimetres long by 4 centimetres high. The device's job is to transmit its identification and other relevant data to the antenna in response to a 915 MHz trigger. The antenna relays this information to the roadside reader, which in turn sends it to a central computer. The transponder does not require an external power source. Instead, it has an internal lithium battery with a lifespan of 15 years. The microwave level is low, which ensures that the system poses no biological hazards. The transponder is fairly simple inside. It consists of a dipole antenna, a local oscillator, and a detector which triggers a CMOS ASIC. The Plessey-designed ASIC contains the vehicle identification number and any other information that is required. GEC Plessey is now looking to extend the AVI concept and apply it to a variety of vehicle tagging applications. For instance, as GPS's microwave marketing manager Sean Nalon explained, car hire companies are particularly interested in using tagging as a simple way to identify the engines of their cars, as well as the chassis. Apparently, a popular scam is to hire a new car similar to your own clapped-out machine and swap the engines over. While all cars are made with chassis numbers and engine numbers, to read them requires a fair amount of oily spanner work. A handheld interrogation system would be far quicker and simpler. AVI is obviously aimed at security and identification on a fairly large scale, but for those of us who want to simply keep track of our own cars, the usual approach is to buy a car alarm. Unfortunately, while car alarms have always seemed a very good idea in theory, in practice they seem to be so unreliable that one might as well have some random noise generating machine installed in the blimmin' car. The problem is that most car alarms you can buy today are based on ultrasonic or infrared frequencies, and this is the reason why they tend to go off at random so often, and why people tend to simply ignore them. These false alarms are caused by vibrations or changes of temperature, which can be due to almost anything, even a dog barking nearby. GEC Plessy is addressing this problem with a new microwave Doppler sensor intruder alarm. The low-cost alarm, which is designed to be retrofittable, sits in the back of a car and emits a controlled low-frequency microwave band, limited to the inside of the vehicle. The alarm is triggered only when movement is detected inside the car, so it doesn't suffer from the high false alarm rates of current systems. The alarm has already been successfully demonstrated and should be in production volume by October. Perhaps more interesting in terms of technology, rather than instant volume business, is the work being done in the millimeter wave area. GPS is currently evaluating active cruise control and car-to-car and car-to-roadside communication systems. Both applications rely on a new quasi-optical antenna technique rather than the traditional waveguide-fed antenna approach method. The new approach, which GEC Plessy is currently patenting, should dramatically cut the cost of millimeter wave components, opening up these frequency bands to a far greater number of applications.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter, 'cause it's gone.
Tuesday, of course, Melanie. Sparks from Radio Facts, continuing with microwaves take to the road. intelligent cruise control is the next logical stage. Using this low-cost millimeter wave technique, it is possible to put a whole millimeter wave radar in a box inside your car headlamp and use this to automatically monitor the time-speed interval between you and the car in front. The information from the radar is passed onto your car's central processing unit, which in turn activates the accelerator or the ABS braking system, thus automatically controlling your proximity to the car in front. It's basically a high-tech approach to collision avoidance. GEC Plessy's millimeter wave cruise control has been demonstrated in various vehicles in collaboration with other companies and automotive manufacturers, who are evaluating various cruise control techniques as part of various EEC projects, including Prometheus. A variation on this theme is a 60 GHz car-to-car and car-to-roadside communication system that GEC Plessy is working on in collaboration with Marconi Command and Control and SEL Stuttgart. This project is part of the EEC Drive program, the point being to develop a distributed road users information system that will allow drivers as well as the police, etc., to relay data on traffic, roadworks and so on. It is hoped that such a system would help to reduce the number of traffic accidents and cut down on road congestion to improve traffic flow. Because of the large volumes involved, the expanding automotive market is attracting the attention of almost every sector of the electronics industry at the moment. However, a company like GEC Plessy, with experience in rugged military microwave technology, should be very successful in this field. Components used in a car, even when not under the bonnet, have to be able to withstand constant vibration and extremes of heat and cold, while equipment used on the roadside or on motorway bridges must be able to cope with all varieties of weather, as well as dust, vibration noise and fumes. But ultimately, the success of microwave or millimeter wave technology in this market, well, one suspects, depend less on how well it works than on how much it costs. That was from Components in Electronics, written by Chris Evans Pugh. This is Sparks. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us all about yourself, where you live and what you do. I promise to give you a mention on this programme. I'll give you the address in a bit. But first, Depeche Mode. Play this for my friends in Hungary.
Spare a few. Radio Fax started its test transmissions this year on the 19th of April. On the subsequent Sunday, we put out an announcement about our return, part of which went rather like this. What about programming then? We're on the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We will have our own Radio Fax programme of gold music for some of the time. But if you would like to have your programme transmitted by Radio Fax on an occasional or regular basis, please get in touch. Our address, as 3 years ago, is Radio Fax. Well, following that announcement, we were contacted by somebody purporting to be from Radio Caroline, and they were interested in taking 16 hours of airtime on Radio Fax every day. As you obviously know, it didn't actually materialise. Now, there's an article here, it's rather old now, but it's from Now Radio from about 1 month ago, and it's mostly about the satellite saga. But what it does do is it outlines some of the conflicts for the Caroline organisation in deciding which direction to go with changes in the law recently. Caroline, the end of an era? Question mark. The national dailies are already writing the obituary for Radio Caroline, the archetypal pirate, which for 27 years has flown the flag of radio piracy and carried the spirit of the massive 60s revolution in radio broadcasting. Caroline was the launching pad for careers as diverse and variously successful as those of Simon Dee, Kenny Everett, and Tony Blackburn. That, depending on your viewpoint, may be a double-edged compliment. But Caroline is also credited with forcing the radio shake-up, which led to the reorganisation of BBC Broadcasting and the creation of Radio 1. Some would say that the current local and incremental opportunities are direct descendants of Caroline's huge popularity and maverick romantic appeal to generations of music fans, some of whom were scarcely born when the pirate first went on the air. Hence the emotional note in much of the reporting of Caroline's final capitulation to overwhelming legal and bureaucratic odds. The Ross Revenge is described as a pathetic, rusting, semi-derelict hulk riding at anchor off the Kent coast and slowly falling victim to the corrosion of the hostile elements. Whatever the reality may be, and the Ross Revenge is certainly looking a little worse for wear, the drama of Caroline is very much an ironic combination of the physical and spiritual plight of the legend. Salt spray and heavy seas are taking their physical toll. The Broadcasting Act, in force since January this year, is sapping the spirit. And it is the gulf between the pragmatists, who see going legitimate and securing a license to broadcast via satellite as the only salvation, and the romantics, who feel passionately that broadcasting from a ship is still the essence of the Caroline spirit, which is preventing the station from surviving into the 1990s. The story is arguably of interest to everyone in the radio broadcasting industry today, since many owe their presence in UK radio to what grew out of the serious questions posed by Caroline in the 1960s. It is not that easy to piece together what has been going on over the past few weeks and months. It depends on who you ask. But one version of events indicates that serious disagreements in the Caroline camp are ideological rather than practical. The Broadcasting Act 1990, in force since January, was a severe blow. The positioning of the transmitter outside the 12-mile limit, which allowed Caroline to bait and tantalise authority to such swashbuckling effect, is no longer a protection. Authority is no longer confined by that imaginary line dividing the high seas from territorial jurisdiction, and has powers to pursue pirates beyond its limits. This is where Chris Carey and the Astra satellite come into the picture. It was Carey who approached Caroline late last year with an offer of daytime space on the Astra satellite. Radio Nova, according to his colleague Vincent Monsi, was broadcasting over Astra, but advertising was scarce, and it was the religious broadcasting which was paying. It was decided to continue with the nighttime religious broadcasting, but to terminate the daytime broadcasting. The lease on the satellite ran to May this year. So Carey offered to broadcast 8 hours of Caroline tapes a day, free of charge, to keep the station alive during the day to boost nighttime continuity listening. The arrangement was taken up just before Easter and appeared to be working well, with Caroline having 8 daytime broadcasting hours and Carey the other 16 hours. It transpired that there were 4 further hours to spare. So Caroline began running 2 hours live in the morning and another 2 hours in the evening. The live broadcasting was largely made up of on-air phone-in time. This is where the romantic lobby, or boat people, as Monsi calls them, began to make more vehement appeals to the public to help keep the physical symbol, the boat, as a going concern. Clearly, this led to questions about what Caroline's ultimate intentions were. Did the pirates see Astra as a temporary stopgap whilst getting Ross Revenge refurbished and back in business? If so, Carey could be accused of aiding and abetting Caroline's intention to contravene the Marine Offences Act and the Broadcasting Act 1990. The Caroline camp was split, with some of their disagreement spilling over into unseemly on-air live argument. It was probably at this point that Carey, mindful of his own position and the practicalities of keeping Caroline alive, well, and on the right side of the law, asked the famous question, quote, "Do you want to be in the broadcasting business or the scrap metal business?" According to Monsi, the answer was, sadly but unequivocally, the scrap metal business. In other words, the physical symbol of the boat, rusty and ill-equipped as it was seen to be inseparable from all that Caroline stands for. How could the swashbuckling pioneer of free choice in radio tamely submit to the indignity of doing things by the book, which for nearly 3 decades it has successfully flouted? Emotionally, the argument has undoubted appeal. The reason why Caroline has such a place in the hearts of the public is precisely to do with the charm of putting 2 fingers up at a fuddy-duddy, out-of-touch, behind-the-times bureaucracy. But this is 1991. The long arm of the law, effectively extended by the Broadcasting Act, is capable of punishing wrongdoers. In the face of such practicalities, satellite has to be the route to survival. But where will Caroline be once absorbed into the fold of legitimacy? Just another Radio 1? Nothing intrinsically wrong with that. But the legend of the 60s is effectively emasculated, tamed, taken from the weekend revolutionaries, and handed back to authority. Perhaps this is the time to thank Caroline for its contribution to the growth of radio broadcasting in Europe, and to allow the Ross Revenge to grow old gracefully, along with the generation which was inspired by it. We all have to grow up sometime, and romance doesn't pay the mortgage.
Not a very positive note to end on. We have Andy Bradgate with us in the studio. He's going to be talking later on and with some stuff about what is really happening in Caroline these days. And in the meantime, some 10cc.
Welcome morning, Judge, how are you today? I'm in trouble. so I let it be. I couldn't stop it, so I let it be. I couldn't stop it, so I let it be.
French scientist developed a machine claimed to be able to blow people up, which with sound alone. This extract from Supernature by Lyle Watson gives the story. Professor Gavrode is an engineer who almost gave up his post at an institute in Marseille because he always felt ill at work. He decided against leaving when he discovered that the recurrent attacks of nausea only worried him when he was in his office at the top of the building. Thinking that there must be something in the room that disturbed him, he tried to track it down with devices sensitive to various chemicals and even with a Geiger counter. But he found nothing until one day, nonplussed, he leaned back against the wall. The whole room was vibrating at a very low frequency. The source of this energy turned out to be an air conditioning plant on the roof of the building across the way, and his office was the right shape and the right distance from the machine to resonate in sympathy with it. It was this rhythm, at 7 cycles per second, that made him sick. Fascinated by the phenomenon, Gavrode decided to build machines to produce infrasound so that he could investigate it further. In casting around for likely designs, he discovered that the whistle with a P in it issued to all French gendarmes produced a whole range of low-frequency sounds. So he built a police whistle 6 feet long and powered it with compressed air. The technician who gave the giant whistle its first trial blast fell down dead on the spot. A post-mortem revealed that all his internal organs had been mashed into an amorphous jelly by the vibrations. Gavrode went ahead with his work more carefully and did the next test out of doors, with all observers screened from the machine in a concrete bunker. When all was ready, they turned on the air slowly and broke the windows of every building within 1/2 mile of the test site. Later, they learned to control the amplitude of the infrasound generator more effectively and designed a series of smaller machines for experimental work. One of the most interesting discoveries to date is that the waves of low frequency can be aimed and that 2 generators focused on a particular point even 5 miles away produce a resonance that can knock a building down as effectively as a major earthquake. These frequency 7 machines can be built very cheaply, and plans for them are available for 3 French francs from the Patent Office in Paris. That was from Supernature by Lyle Watson. Well, here's an appropriate record to follow up that story with, and looking at the cover of the record, it looks like they've been experimenting with the machine I just mentioned. It's, of course, the greatest band ever in the history of the world. They're called The Damned, and this is Smash It Up. We'll be fine now.
From electronics world and wireless world, changing fashions in liquid crystals. Anyone who believes that liquid crystals are limited to LCD displays and thermochromic heat-sensitive paints should have gone along to the recent fashion show organised to mark the 150th anniversary of the Royal Society of Chemistry. There they would certainly have had their eyes opened wide. Almost two decades after the pioneering work on liquid crystals, Merck Industrial Chemicals has succeeded in incorporating them in microcapsules 10 to 15 microns in diameter. As a natural extension of this development, they went on to mix the microcapsules into screen printing ink to make high fashion garments that change colour, chameleon-like, with the temperature of the wearer or their surroundings. Mark Artson of Merck explains how an apparently black dress suddenly acquires a red colour when first put on. As it warms up, it can go through a complete spectrum, that is, if the wearer ever reaches 45 degrees centigrade. Hot spots on the body become immediately apparent, as do parts that have been touched. Artson speculates that in future, nightwear might be a rather interesting development.
Six 205 and 12255. This is Sparks, programme of technical news and features, every Monday on Radio Facts, presented by Prof Parker, Trevor Brook, Ruth Phillips and Andy Bradgate. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us all about yourself, what you live, where you live, I mean, and what you do. I promise to give you a mention on this programme. We're also running a weekly unlicensed radio feature, and we need your help for that. Please send in reports of pirate stations you've heard recently. Shortwave, FM or medium wave reports are all appreciated, or perhaps like Andy Bradgate, you've built a long wave pirate transmitter. Write and tell me about it anyway. It's Sparks, The Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Here's Desmond Decker. You probably only know him for doing The Israelites, but I've got a whole album here and The Israelites isn't on it, but this is.
Stalemate in the air. Here's a piece by Colm Kenny. Now, he's a barrister who lectures in broadcasting at Dublin City University. Efforts to open up broadcasting in the Republic of Ireland have run into problems. Dr. Colm Kenny blames political mismanagement. If the Irish experience of unravelling the established broadcasting order is anything to go by, then the British should tread warily when restructuring a system which has served them well. At present, broadcasters and producers in the Republic of Ireland are reeling from shock as recession combines with political mismanagement of their working environment to leave the industry dazed. The idea was a simple one, and it appealed to a government which regarded the news and current affairs provided by national broadcaster Radio Televisie Éireann, RTE, as too left-wing. RTE had a monopoly, with 4 radio services and 2 television channels, funded by a mix of licence fees and advertising. So, even under European law, a change was required to permit competition. But what the government actually did was motivated more by politics than by economics. In relation to television, there was to be a new third channel. Suggestions that one of the RTE channels might be franchised out was never examined seriously because the minister wanted no truck with RTE. With 1 in 3 Irish homes cabled and a nationwide system of microwave video distribution, MVDS, being introduced for the others, TV3 was even thought not to need a conventional transmission system. On the radio side, there would be a plurality of choice, with community stations being promised at the same time as purely commercial ones. To supervise the new minimalist era, as the Minister for Communications described it, there would be an independent radio and television commission, IRTC, chaired by a retired Supreme Court judge and staffed with a minuscule number of employees. As radio licences were issued to 24 local radio stations and one national competitor for RTE, it became clear that the IRTC was interested primarily in the length of the pockets of the promoters. Mention was made of requirements for programme content, but costings of programme schedules were limited. The more commercially hard-nosed the applicant, the better seemed to be its prospects of success in the eyes of the IRTC. Commercial stations have generally failed to attract the kinds of audience they expected, and in most cases have been criticised for their content. The most noticeable failure has been Century Radio, the new national service, whose rich backers had no track record in broadcasting, and whose signal still cannot be received through much of Ireland. Attempts to salvage Century by bringing in financial and management support from London's Capital Radio have not so far shown spectacular results, and are resented by many commentators and politicians who object to Ireland's first privately owned commercial radio service being controlled so readily from London. Century is now basically a music station in search of a workable format. At a local level, some radio stations have achieved a following, but in their desperate search for a niche, they have been allowed a far freer hand as regards programming than one would expect from reading the Radio and Television Act of 1988. Meanwhile, on the television side, TV3 stands on the edge of a precipice. 2 years after receiving the franchise, the promoters have still not signed a contract, and the chief promoter, Windmill Lane Studios, has encountered financial difficulties which are due in part to its having to bear most of the development costs. The first major problem for TV3 arose when it emerged that government claims for the potential reach of MVDS were not going to measure up to the reality. It was clear, after all, that TV3 would need its own terrestrial transmission system, and it needed a change in the law to permit that. But, more to the point, it soon became obvious that RTE would continue to dominate the advertising market in the new deregulated era. With revenue to RTE from TV licences failing to keep pace with inflation, the station has in recent years received most of its income from big advertisers. And these were happy to stick with the devil, which they knew could deliver a national audience. In a country where 2 out of 3 homes receive British television from cable, MVDS, or off-air, and where 1 in 3 receive many other English language channels by cable, RTE has managed to adapt, and with a far smaller budget than its British competitors, has continued to make programmes which hold a bare majority of viewers at peak viewing times in multi-channel areas. Becoming desperate at the prospect of its plans for re-regulation collapsing, the government stepped in last summer with a new bill which capped RTE's permitted revenue from advertising. The parliamentary debate which followed was furious and acrimonious, with the government ignoring most professional advice and pursuing what many saw as a bloody vendetta against RTE as it pushed the bill through. With TV3 still not on the air, the reduction in RTE advertising has hit independent producers hard, especially coming as it does at a time of recession and penny-pinching in UK television companies. Revenue lost to broadcasting at RTE has gone to the newspapers and to Ulster Television, which is widely received in the Republic, and which has a quietly acquisitive approach to sales there. A cabinet reshuffle and the appointment of a new Minister for Communications this year has led to hopes that the government may be persuaded to review what is rapidly becoming a disaster for Irish broadcasters and producers concerned about quality. That piece by Dr. Colm Kenny, who's a barrister and who lectures in broadcasting at Dublin City University.
Brilliant. Kate Bush, the saxophone song. It's Sparks from Radio Fax 6205 and 12255 every Monday, the weekly programme of technical news and features. Electronic anti-noise, the sounds of silence. Legislation is being used against manufacturers to build quiet into their products, and these requirements are likely to become even more stringent. From Design Engineering, Lane Whitwood reports on the electronic noise and vibration control methods being developed. One of the less fortunate aspects of the Industrial Revolution was the increase in noise that economic progress entailed. Modern-day machines may not always produce the shattering din of their predecessors, but, as any inhabitant of the environs of an airport will tell you, the numbers have increased to compensate. National and European legislation is putting pressure on manufacturers to incorporate quiet into their products. These requirements are likely to become more stringent as the single market approaches. One solution has been around since the 30s, waiting to be noticed commercially. It needed the advances in solid-state electronics of the 80s to become a viable noise-attenuating technology. Anti-noise is based on a relatively simple formula of wave cancellation. Sound and vibration can be blocked by synthesizing inverse waves with equal amplitude and frequency components, yet an opposite phase component. When the two waves meet, the resulting energy turns into low-level heat. Although the basic theory is a straightforward one, the skill lies in performing the process accurately at the instant required. Low-cost digital signal processing, or DSP, able to deal with the variable speed algorithms, can predict and simulate mirror image waves, and now has the power and speed required to cancel complex multi-speed repetitive or random signals. One of the major companies in this field, US and UK-based ANVT, claims that the applications are limitless. Products under development are its electronic muffler to cancel unwanted engine noise and an in-vehicle quieting system, a headrest to create a zone of silence, and electronic engine mounts to isolate engine vibration from the body of a vehicle. ANVT's electronic control systems require sensing devices such as microphones, a synchronization sensor on the noise or vibration source, loudspeakers, and a powerful microprocessor. Sensing devices sample the signal to be attenuated and transmit the resulting information to the microprocessor or controller. The controller then analyzes the wave present and synthesizes the 180 degree out of phase equivalent. The entire process takes milliseconds. Noise and vibration control has proven most effective at reducing low frequency repetitive waves. Frequencies of 600 Hz and below are the most difficult to reduce with traditional means, such as lead sheeting, fiberglass or acoustic foam. And it is these waves which cause fatigue, hearing loss and decreased efficiency. ANVT holds rights to two groups of patents necessary for the implementation of the electronic control process. Developed in the late 70s, the Chaplin patents attack the problems of repetitive noise, e.g. noise from an engine or generator which is cyclical or predictable in nature. Repetitive systems use a synchronization pulse to lock the electronic control system into the timing of the noise source. The signature of the noise source can be accurately predicted, and the anti-phase waves produced quickly with each firing cycle of the engine. The patents developed under Glenn Warnecker deal with randomly generated noise or vibration, such as noise from wind, tires, or air conditioning. Rather than predict the unwanted noise signature, random systems monitor delays in the environment, performing real-time predictions of the anti-phase waves. As extremely high-speed signal processing is required to perform the process, random control technology is on the cutting edge, evolving as high-speed DSP becomes more economical. Continuing electronic anti-noise, the sounds of silence from design engineering. Noise and vibration control technology is currently at what is known as the near-commercial stage. Firms like ANVT, with its Active One noise and vibration controller, are using an adaptive approach to active control, integrating learning-based systems. These assume that there is an insufficient amount of computer power to draw many of the conclusions required to achieve optimum cancellation in dynamic industrial environments. The program design differs from that of a conventional process system in two ways. Firstly, the processor is programmed to execute on one of two routes to development of the anti-noise waveform. The first path is the normal computation algorithm. The alternative route is an adaptive control that has a matrix solution based on a series of pre-agreed factors. Secondly, the system is programmed with an empty set of default matrices. The computer characterizes the matrix as it first confronts the noise situation. The capability of storing characteristics taken at a number of engine speeds allows data concerning both system and noise characteristics to be obtained. If the engine changes speed while operating, a learning-based system calls up the stored data as opposed to recharacterizing and obtains a more accurate starting point from which to initiate the cancellation process. After sensing a change in engine speed, it remembers the data stored previously to allow cancellation at the current altered engine speed. Automotive exhaust noise or interior cabinet silencing for aerospace are possible applications. The ANVT electronic muffler, currently being developed for several European car manufacturers' 1993 models, utilizes a DSP computer with a cancelling actuator connected to the engine via a straight pipe to cancel unwanted or engine exhaust noise. The DSP chip with a clock speed of 20 MHz allows for rapid adaptation to car engine speed changes. Sensing devices located within the system detect exhaust noise generated by the engine. They relay the noise in the form of electrical systems to the DSP computer. The DSP analyzes the information and generates mirror image electrical signals. These inverse signals are then introduced through transducers into the electronic muffler system canister. Cancellation occurs within milliseconds. The latest version attenuates exhaust noise by up to 20 decibels. Unlike the traditional car exhaust muffler, the electronic muffler also eliminates the back pressure on the engine that occurs when exhaust gas is channeled through the muffler, thus improving the fuel efficiency of the engine. While developing the system, the move from research to commercialization necessitated actuator modification. The conventional stereo speaker, for example, must be transformed into effective pressure actuators. Chamber configuration, together with efficient loudspeakers, has increased speaker response considerably. Currently 1.5 times the size of a conventional electronic muffler, the electronic prototype is now being reduced to 2 to 3 times its current size. The devices are constructed using materials such as Kevlar, which can withstand prolonged exposure to hostile environments such as that of the automotive exhaust, or indeed the heat duct of a commercial structure or the exhaust outlet of a chemical plant. Vibration actuators have also been refined to a reduced size, enabling replacements of conventional motor mounts, for example, which are capable of cancelling out random vibration. That was from Design Engineering by Lane Whitwood.
But I don't need you.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax on 6205 and 12255. A new generator was recently installed on the Ross Revenge and has now given 7 weeks of continuous trouble-free service. For those of you who are interested in the technical details, it's a two-cylinder Petta diesel engine driving a 12.5 kVA alternator at 1500 RPM, giving the usual 240/415 output voltage. However, for the electrics on the Ross Revenge, it is cranked up to about 1700 RPM, which gives about 450 volts. This is not the same as the 460 volt 60 Hz supply given by the existing six-cylinder MAN generators, but while the ship is off the air, it's near enough. The unit is installed at the front starboard corner of the generator room and is wired into the old two-way switchboard that was taken out of service when the V12 generator was installed, along with a new three-way switchboard. The unit is water-cooled with its own radiator, so there are none of the problems associated with seawater corrosion. It has two distinct advantages over the larger generators. Firstly, it is much less thirsty than the big ones, drinking only about 2.5 litres per hour compared with more than 40, and the engine is small enough to be cranked by hand in the event of a total power and battery failure. Hopefully, though, that won't ever happen. The only external indication of its existence is a new exhaust pipe, parallel to the large ones running up the front mast, which passengers on the Olau ferries might just be able to see with the naked eye on their way to Holland.
You're sending the tubes, mistaken for lilies. You give me your lip at the punch and the silly. You turn my head till it rolled down your brain drain. If I had any sense now, I wouldn't want it back again. New Amsterdam, it's begun much too much. Till I have the possession of every virtue touches. Till I step on. Let's speak double dutch, do a real double dutches. Down on the mainspring, listen to the tick-tock. Clack all the faces that move in on your block. Twice shy and dark-tied because you've been bitten. Everything you say now sounds like it was ghost-ridden. New Amsterdam, it's become much too much. Till I have the possession of everything she touches. Till I step on the brake to get out of the clutches. Till I speak double dutch, do a real double dutches. Back in London they'll take you to heart after a little while. Oh, I look right at home, I still feel like an exile. Somehow I found myself down at the dark side. Thinking about the old days of Liverpool and Rotherhide. Transparent people who live on the other side, living a life that is almost like suicide. New Amsterdam, it's become much too much. Till I have the possession of everything she touches. Till I step on the brake to get out of the clutches. Till I speak double dutch to a real double duchess.
Woof, woof, bibble, bibble, bip, ping, ping, boing, bedoing, woof, woof. Oh, sorry, we're live. This is Sparks from Radio Fax you're listening to at the moment. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us all about yourself, where you live and what you do. We promise to give you a mention on this programme. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6... 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, or 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
There's always undercover, and I talk to my daddy, say, send your
Hello, it's Sparks from Radio Facts. Now, a regular feature of this these programmes is going to be reading out your letters on air. And here's a letter, however it wasn't written to us.
Can't TV reporters and children's presenters utter one sentence without cluttering it up with the word actually? Are they trained to use it? They should be taught instead that it's actually irritating, intrusive and actually quite boring. That's from actually quite outraged from Cheltenham.
From Patty's postbag. Well, of course, very interesting. Actually, here's the House Martins, actually.
What a good place to be. Don't believe it, cause you speak a different language and it's never
something I'm bringing.
Don't believe it, oh no, cause it's never
something I'm bringing.
No, oh, oh. It's another night up with a boss, following footsteps overgrown by moss, and he tells me good women grown trees, and if you catch them right they will land upon the knees, where they open all the wallets and they close all the minds. They love to buy you all a drink. And if we ask all the questions, then you take all your clothes up and back to the kitchen sink. What a good place to be. Don't believe it. Speak a different language and it's never
really happened
to me. Don't believe it. Oh no. Cause it's never been
happened
to me. What a good place to be. Don't believe it. Speak a different language and it's never really happened to me. Don't believe it. Oh no. Cause it's never
been happened
to me. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe it.
From Electronics Times. Too late for Telepoint? Has the Telepoint bubble burst, or is there still life in the industry that was going to take on and perhaps even beat the cellular radio operators? The next few months should clear the air. Last week, Mercury signalled a crucial change in its commitment to the cordless technology, with the broadest of hints that it now sees personal communications networks, rather than its Telepoint service, as the future for mobile telephony. This week is high noon for the Zone phone service, as Ferranti Credit Phone comes up against the self-imposed deadline for selling its majority stake in the pioneering Telepoint network, putting another huge question mark over Telepoint. Ferranti has been trying for almost a year to rid itself of Zone phone, despite the fact that it sees itself as the pioneer of Telepoint technology. and despite the estimated $20 million had sunk into the venture. The two other telepoint operators, the BT-led PhonePoint Consortium and BYPS, are also struggling to attract users. It was not meant to be so. At its launch in 1987, the various backers of telepoint were boasting of a future mass-market mobile communications system, spanning the whole country within a few years and serving as many as 10 to 11 million subscribers within a decade. The reality is somewhat different. Perhaps 10,000 of the handheld telepoint sets are in use, with even fewer paying customers. As for national coverage, you would be hard-pressed to find more than a handful of base stations outside of city centres. Ferranti executives are quite candid about where most of the blame lies. The government was quite mad to license as many as four operators right from the start. They feel aggrieved that having pioneered the technology, the likes of BT and Shea will never concede that. Ferranti should have been allowed to exploit it here in the UK first, and then in Europe. But that may sound like sour grapes. It was probably bowing too much to the god of open competition and market forces to start an untried radio communication service with four operators. But a bigger mistake made by the government was to license three PCNs, even before Telepoint had been given a chance to prove its mettle. That just fostered uncertainty and confusion among the Telepoint community and potential users. Of course, the licensed CT2 operators must take some of the blame. Those that did launch had little to sell, and made a mess of marketing even that. They raised expectations that could not possibly be met with so few base stations. The lack of standards again led to confusion, and the few customers on the proprietary networks found them unreliable and expensive to use. Despite these tales of woe, it may be too soon to write off Telepoint. Some of the operators are about to breathe life into the technology by launching a service based on the Common Air Interface, or CAI, standard, and adding many more base stations, so that phones on one network may at last be able to use another operator's base station. The handsets have also been redesigned to offer, and thus exploit, the synergy between paging and Telepoint. And hopefully we will see more adventurous marketing of the technology, now targeted as a rival to the fixed phone two-way service at home and at work, the so-called neighbourhood Telepoint concept heralded in the government's white paper. The mobile features would be touted as an added extra, rather than a poor man's cellular service. It might just work, but, like many pioneers before, Ferranti will not be there to reap any rewards. And if this second attempt fails, Telepoint will be consigned to the telecommunications history books as just another technology pioneered here that didn't make the grade.
Won't you keep on going back to be young again, to find the time.